Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. What should we make of the Biden ceasefire, which apparently originated in Israel, that the Israeli government fails to own? Is this merely cheap domestic political posturing or a reflection of the moral rot of American foreign policy? Probably both. Crosstalking Palestine, I'm joined by my guest, Giorgio Cafiero in Washington. He is CEO of Gulf State Analytics. In New York, we have Lionel. He is a legal and media analyst. And in Reston, we have Michael Maloof. He is a former Pentagon senior security policy analyst. Our gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, let me go to you first here. It's been about a week now since Joe Biden announced to the public a ceasefire that he says originated in Israel. Why he is the one that announced it is unclear to me. And the usual parameters that we've seen, something that was 3 weeks before, the Israeli government, for the most part, has distanced itself from it, particularly the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So what is going on here? Was that just for domestic consumption? Is Biden somehow throwing in the towel? What do you make of it? I mean, it's been about a week, and I still don't understand what's going on.
Well, it's my understanding that it originated from Israel. The United States tweaked it, sent it back, said it was Israel's idea, Israel's plan. But no one on Netanyahu's team really buys into it, particularly his more extreme right, rabid ministers, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. So I think the whoever originated it. It's clear now that Netanyahu did. I mean, Haaretz is basically conceding that it came out of Tel Aviv. But it is, to get to your other point, it is trying to make the United States look like, and I think maybe in a backhanded way, Netanyahu's trying to help Biden's reelection prospects by saying, it was his idea, and he's trying to bring this thing to a. Trying to put more lipstick on that proverbial pig. And unfortunately, it's not working. Things are going to increase in Palestine. And at the same time, we're also seeing war drums being beaten to go northward toward Lebanon. But Israel will not be able to really effectively do anything northward unless and until it calms down in Gaza, and they're far from achieving whatever they wanted to achieve there, and in fact, they've emboldened Hamas.
Well, I don't know. I'm not really sure, Giorgio. I mean, to date, the Americans have never said no to what the Israelis want. So, I mean, if the recent past is a guide to the future. It doesn't really matter. I mean, essentially, Biden has egg on his face. I don't know if you gentlemen came across the interview in Time magazine, but I mean, this is a very incoherent, and I'm being gentle here, administration when it comes to foreign policy, particularly the topic we're talking about right now, Palestine. Giorgio in D.C., what do you think?
Yeah, first of all, great to be on your program. I would say that there is, when we look at the past 8 months of this conflict, there is really no evidence that at any point the Biden administration has put real pressure on Israel. Yes, we've heard statements. We've heard the administration voice opinions. It has its preferences. But all that matters are actions. And when it comes to the actions of the Biden administration, there has been no real pressure on Israel. This speech that was delivered the end of May, I think it's kind of interesting, though, to consider the motivations that Biden had for delivering the speech. I do think the Biden team would like to see this war wind down. Again, there's the question of what they would actually do to pressure Israel to do it. That's the important question. But nonetheless, I think the Biden team does have an incentive to see the war end. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the White House is obsessed with the idea of expanding the Abraham Accords. Before the vote in November, Biden wants to be able to tell U.S. voters that he was the president that brought Saudi Arabia into a normalization deal with Israel, And Biden and Blinken and all those folks know that that's not going to be possible as long as the war in Gaza is going on. And at the same time, I think motivation that Biden had for putting forth this proposal is to try to make Israel seem less isolated. But I mean, none of this has to do with any concern for the Palestinian people. It's all about these other U.S. interests.
Well, it's all about perceptions more than anything else. It's not changing any realities. And I think that's what is so pathetic about it. Lionel, I mean, I asked him in my introduction, is this posturing? I mean, you know, he does have a nominating convention ahead of him and a general election in November. And he's in a lose-lose situation the longer this goes on for his administration and his party. Lionel.
I want to play a thought experiment. I want to jump to the future and look back as a historian who's describing what we're seeing right now. And as a future historian looking back, I will say, look at the artful use of the euphemism. We are talking about ceasefire. Nobody is talking about the senseless annihilation, massacre, genocide, slaughter, whatever you want to call it, of innocent human beings. We're talking about ceasefire and posturing and weapons and peers. We're talking about everything but. We're also suggesting ceasefire implies that Israel will cease the firing, as will what? The Gazans? Is it Hamas? Is it? We don't get to that. It sounds that there is this juggernaut, that there is this impasse. We'll stop shooting and destroying if you do as well. In the meantime, we went from debating whether it was genocide, whether it was apartheid. That's off the table. And now we're talking about the idea of ending something. And what I say, gentlemen, is that if the American public and the world really understood what this was about, if we could see the actual example of incomprehensible slaughter, this debate would stop. There would be a demand of whatever you want to call this, stop it now. Cease, call it whatever you want. This is the part that just enrages me.
Yeah.
We're talking all around the topic. We love to talk about war as chess and not
Lionel,
as a destruction of humanity.
You bring up a good point, and Lionel has been with me ever since this phase of the conflict, since October, as my wingman. And, you know, he is famously known as the guy in the fishbowl. And thank you for that interpretation, because you're absolutely right. Yeah. But Michael, we have Spain joining South Africa at the International Court of Justice, dealing with the conventions of genocide here. The rest of the world is not talking around this. The rest of the world is looking directly at what's going on right now. Does the Biden administration, as Lionel has pointed out, doesn't want to see it that way? Michael.
Well, we're having the effect of isolating not only ourselves, but so is Israel in the world. And this is quickly coming to pass. And there's every increasing indication that even if Trump made it, nothing would change in terms of the Middle East, although I think there are some wobblings. Look, our mutual good friend Alistair Crook put it very interestingly the other day. He said that the Saudis will not go along with any normalization of Israel as long as there's no longer a two-party state. And he says this comes from, it may not necessarily reflect the realities on the ground today, but it comes from the king himself. And if the king has decreed this, that's it. That's law. There's no discussion. And that's the position today. And Israel is not going to agree to that. So they're going to have endless war. That's why now they're going to start aiming, as I said, I think almost imminently now, toward Lebanon. But they've got to calm things down a little bit in Gaza, because they've got to shift troops around.
Yeah, but if they can't calm it,
up 300,000 people.
But I think you could make the argument the other way around. The opposite argument is saying, well, it's not going to calm down, so we expand the conflict. It's focus our attention away. I think, unfortunately, that's where it is. Giorgio, Michael brought up Alistair Crook, which is a brilliant analyst. In the same interview that Michael's making reference to, is he's saying, you can't demand the tide to come in and out. That is the problem. And this is what the Biden administration is doing. It's demanding that the tide come in to carry it out down the path of victory, but that's not going to happen. Joshua, it seems to me that really what the Biden administration is worried about is just manipulating perceptions. It has shown itself to be completely incapable of taking any kind of stand, let alone a moral stand. Go ahead in Washington.
Yeah, you know, we obviously have to keep in mind this is 2024, an election year, and the Biden team is focused on securing a second term. So Biden is in a little bit of a difficult position. On one hand, he does have these concerns about some of the younger and more progressive elements within the Democratic Party who seem to want to stay home on Election Day or maybe vote for a third party candidate. And we look at some of the swing states, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and so on, that could make a difference and give those critical states to Trump. So I think there's sort of some catering, very surface level rhetoric to try to win back some of those voters.
Yeah, but Giorgio, I mean, let's be clear here. The voters that you're talking about, they'd be voting against Biden's policy vis-a-vis Gaza, but they certainly wouldn't be voting for Trump's articulation of what's going on in the conflict. That's almost kind of a more pathetic situation. Keep going.
Yeah, they would not vote for Trump, but the concern from the Biden team is that they wouldn't vote at all. They think they need to have absolutely win every single vote in those states that candidates always win by a very narrow margin. But at the same time, also the Biden team doesn't want pro-Israel billionaire donors to unplug the Biden campaign or the campaigns of Biden's Democratic allies. So I think that ultimately Biden is being very loyal to those donors. But I would also say that if this were not an election year, I'm not so sure that Biden would be handling things too differently. I don't think it's just about catering to donors or catering to the lobby. When you look at Biden's record on Israel-Palestine.
I absolutely agree with you. Keep going, a few more seconds.
For decades, Biden has been a diehard Zionist. We can say the same thing about Blinken and others in the administration. To them, this is an ideological fight that they've been a part of for many decades.
On that thought, gentlemen, I have to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Palestine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Palestine. Okay, Lionel, before we went to the break, we were talking about the impact of the general election in the United States on Biden's policy. And Giorgio is absolutely right. I think that if this were an off-election year, Biden would be acting the same. Having said that, again, I've been stressing all through this program is that they are worried about perceptions more than anything else. They're not interested if there's a genocide or not. That's immaterial to them. It's how they look and how America can project power in the world and the impact on it. It used to be very powerful, American soft power. It's not so powerful anymore. My question to you, Lionel, is how much of the student protests influence policy? Because, you know, I've known you for a very, very long time. And, the blue hairs and the DEI and all of that you and I have talked about endlessly.
Yes.
But I'm very proud of young people in America that have stood
up. Absolutely.
Very proud. How much of an impact did it have? Go ahead.
A couple of things here, not to be too, dare I say, internecine here, but in the Democratic Party, there's something very interesting. A while back, after they completely abandoned Bernie Sanders, a lot of the folks kind of bit their tongue and they said, and they blamed Hillary for this, because this man that they believed and loved in was basically, cast to the side. Now you have groups of people. You had the Squad, and the Squad was kind of laughed at, but you had AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. And then all of a sudden, they started to express and echo the concerns of many, many young people, not just leftist young, but just young people who felt a real connection, as young people have always had historically with anti-war, as you and I, Peter, remember from the Vietnam era.
Yes.
Well, when they acted up and they saw their fellow colleagues, instead of being beaten on campuses, basically academically muted, diplomas withheld. I mean, to be blackballed in the future where you couldn't get a job on Wall Street. They turned to their squad and Bernie and the other Democrats and said, what are you going to do to help us? And they were mute.
Yep.
They said nothing.
Yep.
So when all is said and done, there is going to be a permanent fracture and a chasm within this group. So the effects of this are going to be felt. This generation might be forever lost. They're not going to forget this.
Well, I think,
and let me throw in alternative media as well.
I think, Anil, it's also a reflection of how disaffected young people feel as neoliberalism is reaching a critical stage, okay? I mean, neoliberalism makes everybody miserable except for the very, very rich. That's obvious. And we play this ridiculous conservative liberal game, which, of course, is what they want us to do. But going back to Palestine here, you know, Michael, you were on many, many times as we went through the Russiagate hoax, okay? But even the New York Times, which I hate to cite, but I'm going to right now, they wrote about an influence program originating in Israel to the sum of about $2 million, primarily to influence Congress and actually people of color in Congress. So we have fake meddling in American politics from Russia, but we have very real meddling from Israel in American politics. Thoughts?
Well, it's nothing inconsistent because we do the same thing in other countries' elections. However, it is something that the Israelis now are really trying very hard to get their message across. Netanyahu's supposed to be addressing Congress again soon. There are some Democrats who said they're going to march into the chamber with cops and arrest him because of the ICJ. So it warrant on him. But I don't think that'll happen. But at the same time, they are struggling. They are struggling for the conscience of the young people in America, and they know, and the Israelis know they're losing it, and people are sick of what has happened to the Palestinians and the carpet bombing that continuously goes on, and I think that they're to get to the one point that you made with Lionel, the Biden administration only reacts. It never has a plan to do anything.
Good
it
point.
Doesn't want to show any accomplishments.
That's right.
And I have not. In fact, he has torn apart everything that made America better the last term and made us energy dependent, opened up our borders. Now, what good did that do? How has that bettered the life of anybody?
You know,
it's only made things worse.
You know, Giorgio, I'm glad it was mentioned Netanyahu is being invited to address a joint session of Congress. You know, it seems to me that this is such a slap in the face to people with a conscience. I mean, here we have a very, very weak administration. We have fanatics in Congress. It's all directed pandering to donors. The media goes along with it. And everybody else, no one else has a say in all of it. It is such a kabuki theater. And you know, being outside, far outside of the United States and watching how the rest of the world is reacting, even key American allies in Europe are abandoning this policy. I mean, it's a really strange moment of inflection for me. It's a very weird theater. Giorgio.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what's been going on for decades is that the U.S. has been very isolated on the issue of Palestine, and we can just go to the record book and look at, you know, many U.N. votes going back many, many decades. So in that sense, this is kind of a continuation of something that's existed for so many administrations. But I believe what's going on now in Gaza, obviously this is not the first set of massacres in Gaza, but none of the carnage or bloodshed from past conflicts reached this level. None of them came close, and the whole world is seeing this live streamed on social media day in and day out. And it just seems to have no effect on so many in Congress who just continue to obsess with this idea that the U.S. has to support Israel regardless of what Israel does. You know, I don't think that U.S. support for any country in the world should be unconditional. I think there's always something a country could do that should result in Washington approaching it differently. But there's just this thinking among many lawmakers and foreign policy elites in Washington that there's literally nothing Israel could do that should result in the U.S. ceasing to give it ironclad support. The rest of the world, for the most part, disagrees. There are some countries in Europe that support Israel in this manner. But really, I mean, especially outside of the West, when we talk about the global South, it's just completely a different universe than the United States when it comes to talking about the issue of Palestine. And the U.S. is really isolating itself right now when the issue of Palestine is really sort of front and center on the international stage. I don't think many people in Washington understand the extent to which this foreign policy leaves the U.S. so extremely isolated.
Well, Lionel, it really kind of begs the questions. I mean, is this all, I mean, I don't want to make it too simplistic, but I mean, is this really just donor driven? I mean, you know, is money, you know, the great philosopher Bob Dylan said once, you know, money doesn't talk, it screams. Like, is this the bottom line, Lionel?
Let me give you another thought experiment. Let's say I could go and pull some parts of this equation out, and I were to remove the donor faction completely. I could just somehow metaphysically do that. Would you see a different result? Absolutely. There's no question about that, because you would then, you got to ask, well, who is everyone listening to? And there is a structure that goes back. You mentioned something, Peter, very correct. This is ideology. This is philosophy. This has nothing to do with tactical. You know, I've got to say this. With this week, there was discussions of Ronald Reagan's 20th anniversary since his passing, D-Day, and he talks about the notion of peace and power and helping the little people and American fight. And I always, you know, Spielberg and the usual suspects, who I believe Tom Hanks believes he was in World War II. He honestly thinks he was there. But if you sat there and said, what are you doing now? What is America now? What does the world look like now? What have we learned? The answer is nothing. We love ceremonies, we love flag waving, and we love titular bumper sticker kind of phraseology. But when it comes to really applying the principles that we purportedly believe in, we don't. Not as long as there are people, donors, pulling the strings.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. I mean, Michael, you brought up the possibility of the conflict expanding northward into Lebanon. I don't think there's anything the U.S. would do to stop it, okay? I mean, they don't want it to happen, of course, but there's nothing they can do to stop it. We've seen, you know, we saw, you know, members of Congress wanting to start impeachment proceedings against Biden for stopping one shipment, which probably wasn't even stopped, of weapons going to Israel. This is the kind of pathetic situation where if Netanyahu, who needs to stay in power to stay out of prison, if he wants to go into Lebanon, the U.S. won't, Biden certainly won't stop him.
No, you're absolutely right. And we'll pay lip service to not wanting to do that. We still have a carrier strike group still parked in the Mediterranean to sort of be a deterrent. But Hezbollah is not fazed by that. The reality is that, to get back to what you and Lionel were just saying here for a second, the United States is ideologically bent on heading and doing all of this. This is an ideological dispute. I make a distinction now between the government and the American people. They're two distinct entities. The American people do not support these wars. We've been going on for 23 years nonstop. This is all ideologically driven. And if you listen to Netanyahu, given Biden's Zionist bent, they're all ideologically oriented, and even to the biblical desire to clear out all of the non-Jewish, non-Zionist types, and even going so far as going into Lebanon, and now maybe going into West Bank, but certainly clearing out Gaza, maybe introducing Israeli settlers there. This is what we're hearing, and Biden's going along with it.
Well, so, I mean, you know, but Michael, the problem is here, and I'll let Giorgio finish it up. They would be doing this if, but it's social media. This is what's pushing them back, because everybody's watching. Okay, if this happened in the 1880s, this would have happened already, because no one would have talked about it. 40 seconds, Giorgio. Giorgio, go to you. 40 seconds before we go to the end of the program.
Yeah, well, I would just say it is important to be talking about the situation in Lebanon. I absolutely agree with what's been said here. The Biden team certainly doesn't want that to happen, because they know that that would bring instability in the region to a whole new level and bring the U.S. into a crisis that the U.S. certainly doesn't want in relation not only to Hezbollah, but of course to Iran. But I just hope that there are some people in Israel who have the ability to see how stupid it would be to start an all-out war with Hezbollah. You know, we're 8 months into this war in Gaza, and Hamas is still resisting. If they can't defeat Hamas, yep. I say to the Israelis, well, good luck trying to take out Hezbollah.
Gentlemen, and to my audience here, it just takes one phone call from the President of the United States, and this whole thing would be shut down, but he does not have the courage to do it. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, New York, and in Reston. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.